All right, I'd like to move a little into Emily Dickinson. I just want to show you this. This is a picture of her. Unfortunately, she was, there's been so much misconception about her life, and she's been, you know, pictured as this mousy, unfortunate creature, hot, you know, suffering from a broken heart in her attic and writing these little mousy poems, little mousy rhyming poems. And when her work was discovered, her sister and this, actually a woman named Mabel Todd Loomis, who was the wife of a professor at Amherst, who was quite a bright woman, took on the editing, but they also got involved with creating this myth, the Emily Dickinson myth. And one of the first things they did was touch up this picture of her. it's such a shock, you know, like a visual shock. It's in here somewhere. Look at this. They added curls to her hair and this ruffle around her neck. I mean, it's just so outrageous.
They probably did it with her best interest at heart.
Well, it was the times. You know, I've read account. There's so many different stories about what the, you know, realities were. But they really pushed this broken heart over the minister. I mean, that would sit very well. And I've read accounts, you know, that she was really in love with this woman, and the family came in and changed all the pronouns from she to he. I mean, it's pretty incredible. It's, anything's possible, actually. But I don't know, this sort of sums it up. It's just amazing. But anyway, I think, and I think people are realizing now that more of her work has come to light. In fact, this is, you know, this is kind of a handy little book, but if you can afford the larger Harvard collection, edited by Jackson, it's, that's really the definitive collection of her poems. And there are a lot of things in there that aren't in here. This contains a lot of the more known and popular poems of hers. I think this Sewell biography, it's in two volumes, is pretty good. I haven't read it all through, but he doesn't leave any stone unturned. I mean, he just really tracks these events, and there are all sorts of family, you know, records of when they took this trip or took that trip, and friends of the children. There's a lot about her early life, and she had a very sort of normal, healthy adolescence, a lot of boyfriends, and she sent out Valentines, and the letters are pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. So, Sewell, S-E-W-A-L-L, what's his first name? Richard. There's some pictures in here. And the first volume covers all her, sort of the New England and Puritan heritage, and her grandfather and her great-grandfather, just sort of this history of the family tree. And I think her, she had a kind of interesting grandfather who died in disgrace, of course, later, but, and then an uncle who was a good orator, and it just clears up a lot of sort of facts about her life. There's this idea that she really was completely isolated, you know, didn't have much contact with literature, didn't know what was going on, when in fact she was much more in touch, and it was only after a certain point that she, I think, made a choice to become a recluse. But she was really no stranger than the artist in the garret, except that she was supported. I mean, she wasn't living in abject poverty. But I think you can equate her situation in some way to, you know, a situation that many people share. She was a little cracked, I think, you know, a little odd. Yeah.
One thing that struck me just from a few letters in here was that I think her mother's death must have been decisive also in
I don't know, it's hard to say with things like that. Yeah, she was very close to her father anyway, but he didn't interfere with her life. I don't, you know, there's some story that she had someone asked, this is early on, but pre the minister and so on, but asked for her hand in marriage, and the father didn't want to part with her. And that's just apocryphal. I mean, that he seemed perfectly willing to let her have a normal life. I mean, I think the family deaths, and she was a little morbid. She did get carried away. She always wanted to know the details of anybody's death, and she would write these strange poems that nobody could understand, you know, condolence. Seemingly, you know, supposed to be condolence poems, but they would freak the relatives out. What is this? And she did get weirder as she became more and more reclusive. Never went out, never left the family grounds, just... She would bake bread, which she would send to local neighbors and friends, and she would give little, I guess, things like nosegays and so on to the children. She would drop notes and little gifts from a basket from her window and so on. And her poems were actually found written on backs of shopping lists, you know, grocery lists, invitations to graduations, corners of envelopes. And she lived in a pretty well-to-do situation. I mean, it's not as if they were wanting paper or anything. And these things were found in these little packets in drawers, her poems, wrapped in thread.
You get the feeling she had everything planned for people finding her, or not?
There are all sorts of speculations. I mean, she didn't destroy her work, and certainly... Her life must have been incredibly rich. I mean, when you read more and more of her work and her letters, you just realize what a full, kind of active, mental life she had. And she knew all the passions. I mean, her poems indicate that. I mean, it's almost as if she didn't even have to live them. You know, she was born maybe knowing them or something. Born this incredible experience.
She just wrote them on these papers and stuff.
And she had this very sort of hasty style, uses all these dashes. And of course, when her sister and this Mapletop Loomis came along, they tried to clean up the works, put in punctuation. Also, her dashes were varied. There'd be long dashes, short dashes, dashes that went down, dashes that went up. Who's to say exactly? Not that Poe and certain other poets haven't used dashes, but she only used dashes.
They had meaning, obviously.
Okay, anyway, I have a few notes here, and I'd like to get into some of her meters and talk about specific poems, maybe. She was living at this time which was one of the most exciting times in American writing. Emerson was, I think, at the height of his career, just around when she was born. She was about 17 when his poems came out, and she knew his poems pretty well. It's interesting that he was only living 60 miles away. So if she had been a more outgoing person, you know, you could see that contact, maybe.
Did she correspond with Emerson?
Not that I know of. I don't know. I don't think so. When she was 20, Hawthorne published The Scarlet Letter, and then The House of Seven Gables came out a year later. Also, I think she shares, there's an affinity between her and a lot of these people. I mean, they were coming out of a similar context, New England, sort of Puritan heritage, et cetera. Hawthorne, I mean, there's a real connection there, just the same sort of concerns and questions about the meaning of everything, creation, moral positions, and so on. If anything, she was sort of constantly upbraiding and creation, you know, what is this all about, and took a very almost atheistic stance at times. There are little notes in some of her letters. There was some sort of religious revival going on in her town, and she always wrote that she was not part of it. You know, she didn't want anything to do with it. And in fact, she says somewhere that the only commandment that she ever obeyed was, consider the lilies.
Were the Alcotts living there that time too? Because they came.
I don't know what their.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah, probably. I don't know what the dates are. Emerson, yeah. Emerson was a bit older. Okay, Moby Dick came out in 1851. Poe died in, I think, 49 or 50. I think 49. And then his poems appeared after his death. Walden appeared when she was, excuse me?
Did Poe publish some of his poetry?
Well, it might have been in magazines and so on, but it wasn't, a collection of his poems wasn't readily available. So you have Thoreau's Walden when she's in her 20s. Also, Leaves of Grass, Walt Whitman. There's a comment in one of her letters to this Higginson character, who actually he was the only one she wrote to about her. There's a whole introduction in here by him, if you have this edition. He was he was a Unitarian clergyman, but he wrote a letter in the Atlantic Monthly, Advice to Young Poets, St. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, and encouraging the Writers of America, which Emily saw and then began a correspondence with him. And he went to visit her, and the only description we have of her really sort of firsthand comes from his visit. And he was, I mean, I just don't think he had the same sort of mental powers that she did. I think he didn't totally understand her and saw her as eccentric and so on, but had told her in one of his letters not to even publish her verse. But in one letter to him, she says she's heard of Whitman, but she hears he's too dirty or something like that. So, too dirty. That's
his
not.
But, she just said she heard of him, but she just heard that it was just trash.
Yeah, something.
Indecorous.
So she probably, I don't know. I'm sure she was very curious and would have made it her business to check out a Walt Whitman poem, but who knows? He certainly didn't influence her work. Okay, most of her poems are in these. Well, I'll get into what her poems were in her life. She was born in 1830 in Amherst, Mass., and died 56 years later of Bright's disease. She died in the house she was born. I said that her family was a distillation of all that was New England. Her father was a lawyer who was nominated for the office of lieutenant governor, which he declined. His name was Edward Dickinson. And she admits to adoring her father. I mean, he certainly was a stronger figure than her mother. She went to a seminary, South Hadley Female Seminary, and hated it, and one time ran away, and then eventually left it. She spent some time, a short visit to Washington with her father when he was in Congress for two terms. And on her way back, this is the famous meeting with the Reverend Charles Wadsworth, this married clergyman, whom everyone says, you know, broke her heart. But anyway, after 56, she she never left the house or the family grounds. And she was rarely even seen in the house. When people would go, in fact, Mabel Loomis Todd, the woman who later edited her poems, never actually saw her. She would talk to her. Emily would be behind doorways or hiding up on the staircase. She would remain seated. She'd come down to hear the piano, but she would remain seated in the hall out of sight. And she wrote all these letters. In fact, a lot of her correspondence was through letters. I have a quote here somewhere. Where's it? She considered she took letter writing very seriously. It was the communication between souls in some sense. Her letters are incredible, beautiful, amazing style. One time someone wrote to her, it was a joint letter to Emily and her sister Lavinia, and Emily was very affronted and wrote back, "A mutual plum is not a plum. I was too respectful to take the pulp and do not like a stone. Send no union letters. The soul must go by death alone, so it must by life, if it is a soul. If a committee, no matter." She's very pointed, sort of wit. It's sort of knew what she liked. Okay, so, and then she got weirder, started dressing in white. She refused to be fitted for clothing. She would have her sister do it for her. She would send these little cookies and breads and so on to neighbors, children and neighbors with these strange little notes. And actually in her letters, she often included or would preface a letter with a poem. So a lot of her poems have come to light that way. She published 7 poems anonymously in her lifetime. This, as I was saying, this Higginson character advised her not to publish. If you can believe it. After he writes this letter encouraging the writers of America, and then she sends him some of her best poems, he thought the world wasn't ready. So they found, I think initially, something like 1,700 poems, and now more and more are have come to light. And that actually, that Harvard edition is the best. So she emerged as a poet only after her death, which is sort of interesting. And then, you know, all this interest in her life, which is still a big puzzle. But there seem to be two lines of thought, and one is this, you know, pity and not really checking out the work, you know, getting more hung up on her being a recluse. A recluse. A recluse is like a hermit, just lives alone and gets kind of weird that way. I bet she didn't talk to herself. I don't know. Yeah, right.
There's a great line when she's writing Higginson, and she says, he asked her, why don't you spend more time with other people? And she says, of shunning men and women, they talk of hallowed things aloud and embarrass my dog.
Oh, I like him.
She sends one of her early Valentines says that she won't bite, that the Valentine won't bite. She and the dog is in that Valentine too. I think its name was Carlos.
Yeah.
Okay. She had as her poets' books or texts. First, she always referred to it as her lexicon. It was a copy of Webster's American Dictionary of the English Language, the enlarged edition of 1847. And there's one line of hers where she says, I'm easing my famine at my lexicon. She absorbed a lot of her vocabulary came from her reading. She was an avid reader. About the Bible. The Bible was probably an important text, and actually there are things in her poems, just ways of, she uses the word bleats at some point, and I mean there are things that ring from the Bible. But she has there's a quote somewhere too. Should you ask me my comprehension of a starlit night, awe were my only reply, and so of the mighty book. It stills, incites, infatuates, blesses, and blames in one. A word is inundation when it comes from the sea. Now that's the Bible. And about Shakespeare, she used to say, why do you need anything else? While Shakespeare remains, literature is firm. And instead of sort of borrowing in a surface way, she really sort of plundered these texts. Amazing vocabulary. I mean, I find I constantly have to look up words, you know, that I don't know myself. But also this idea of juxtaposing elemental things with more fundamental things, sort of an idea you might get from the Bible, the big things and the little things, grass, stone, heart, majesty, etc. But she never picked up on the biblical characters or stories as such. It was more the notions or concepts. And she reduces all these things into these very compact lyrics. There's one line I said, the word bleats. Faith bleats to understand. A lot of the poets or people writing at this time were, as poets at any time, I mean, a century later, Pound and so on, were really interested in this, giving the, you know, making it new, injecting life into the dead language, sort of seeing that what came immediately before them was somehow dead or something to react against or whatever. I mean, it's constantly like that. And there are these vast, you know, swingings of the pendulum. I mean, certainly the Puritan ethic or well, Poe and Hawthorne, all of them have this incredible concern, you know, with certain issues that people couldn't have cared less about, you know, a century before in France, say, or, you know, so that's sort of interesting. And it has a lot to do, I think, with the heart, you know, the whole hardship trip, the pioneers, and coming to this new land and being, actually a lot of people came for religious reasons, so they could practice their own religions, but just getting, I mean, there was something sacred about isolation and hardship and austerity and so on. So that sort of breeds this independence in a way, or it's almost like you're just talking to yourself a lot of the time. You become less communicative with the outside world. I think someone somewhere calls her an articulate inarticulate. But things did get pretty inarticulate, I think, in a lot of these little New England communities. So, okay, so she, one way of going about that, kind of getting back into words and making them come alive, was just etymology, you know, studying out the roots of words and finding out where words came from, and that, you know, making associations that way. She would substitute often simple, concrete terms for more abstract ones, and then would do the opposite, you know, giving sort of big meanings to homilies or just little quaint sayings. That was another thing. They tried to clean up her poetry in that sense. I think there's one occasion where they changed the word heft to the word weight. I mean, it's just outrageous. I'm sure she meant heft. Well, she was dead. I mean, no one knew she was a poet. They found these little packets of scribblings and then thought, maybe we have something here, and show them to the outside world. And actually, when her work first came out, there was a very popular response. And then, but she wasn't really taken seriously. In fact, she still isn't taught as a major poet even now. I mean, there's still this confusion, or, you know, this puzzled thing about where she's coming from, if she didn't really act like a poet and keep her manuscripts in order, you know, was she really a poet? I mean, just insane. I've read a lot of little essays, and, you know, people get very upset about her. But anyway, she had no control over how her work came to light. She really had no control over that. So anyway, and then she'd also, to bring new life to words, it was mainly this juxtaposition of words, putting, you know, and themes like using legal jargon to talk about something very amorous, you know. And then changing mood midstream in a poem, going from something very comic to something serious or vice versa. Oh, and the Shakespeare quote is, why is any other book needed? That's what she said of Shakespeare. And then she would also often shift grammatical categories. And there's one, it's not in that book, but I have a copy of this poem here, where she uses the word shrewd as a noun. Could a shrewd advise me? I think maybe shrewd is a form of shrew, but I wasn't able to find that in the dictionary, that shrewd was ever a form of shrew. So shrewd is used as a noun, and it's sort of strange that way. At one point she uses the word, I have a note here from somewhere, pomp, is used as an adjective rather than a noun, that kind of thing. I mean, she doesn't do it a lot, but enough to make you wake up, you know, when you're reading her work. And she liked punning a lot. Some of the puns are probably lost on us. But there's a lovely quote of hers, "How lovely are the wiles of words." She's really in love with words, very, you know, incredibly attentive to language. And so she was probably learned a lot from, you know, her early reading in her father's library. In fact, I'll go into this in a minute. All her poems derive from this hymnody, from the what's called the common meter, and then there are variations on that. But she never had to go out of her father's library to really learn all about metrics, which is sort of interesting. But there's another quote of her saying, "I never consciously touch a paint mixed by another person." And you know she knew Blake. I mean, that seems kind of obvious. And Emerson's poems, probably Poe's poems, that's a fact. But there's never any just imitation in any of her work.
Wasn't there a book that came out about a year or two ago that tried to make a case that she pirated some woman poet, European poet?
I've never seen that.
Yeah, it was written by a man, and he did this analysis of her poetry. It turns out that, or his thesis is that her poems were, you know, cryptic reorganizations of somebody else.
That's outrageous. I mean, there's still, because so much is unsettled about her, anybody can come up with a new theory. Who would this poet be? I mean, I'm sure we would.
It was commonly known, and I just can't recall it.
A.J. Webster wrote it.
He wrote that book? Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I believe it. Okay, a lot of her, you know, some of her vocabulary and technique comes out of this place where she lived, you know, peculiarities of the, you know, these little homilies or New England sayings. She says somewhere also, "I look at things New Englandly." New Englandly, which is pretty incredible. So you have also, she's really awake to what, you know, the change of the seasons and all the plant flowers and trees and everything around her. So the nut and the robin and the different kinds of trees and flowers, particular times, are really. You know, excuse me?
Did she ever?
Not after this time, no. She didn't go to church after. She didn't like going to church. Okay, her poems are very brief. I mean, and she really evolved this almost this incredible ellipsis. Often some of the poems just are so elliptical that you kind of get lost. Don't know quite what she's saying, but she would sort of get rid of all this excess stuff. But she really kept her emotions out of it in a way. I mean, sloppy, sentimental, personal emotions. She kept those out and she often got down to just the pure language bones or whatever. She has a line. It's a poem about writing a love letter. She says here, "Tell him, - I only said the syntax, - and left the verb and the pronoun out." And another technique of hers was just indirection. I mean, and this famous phrase of hers is quoted a lot, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant." I mean, that in itself is so powerful. Okay. I've sort of culled some of this information from just various secondary sources on her, but they all just, what anybody says just makes you want to go back to the poems. In fact, the more, you know, this just isn't even enough. The more you read, the more it just comes alive. But anyway, Emerson, there's a poem of Emerson's He shall I climb for his rhyme. He shall I climb for his rhyme, but mount to paradise by the stairway of surprise. So that's one of the, surprise is really an amazing quality of her work. I mean, you really, nothing's pat or easily solved. Like often her, you know, she'll just take you through a whole journey in one, in a two, you know, two stanza poem. Along and selected, you know, selected one. There's one particularly that stood out. It says something about leaning on the sun, leaning on the sun. And the another version was from Manzanilla come. I mean, it's just Manzanilla being this flower. Manzanilla, Manzanilla root. Some of the, I noticed there are different versions in this book and this Harvard book, and the Harvard book has often the variant lines, so you can sort of see how her, you know, head was working, and make your own choice. Chinese dinner. She complains about being shut up in prose. I think she mostly was read prose, or she made prose with some sort of metaphor for her life. Or I don't know, I'm not quite sure what she means actually, but if only they had peeked in the closet and seen her brain go round, that's her phrase, her brain go round, she says, they would have known she had the madness of a poet who would not stay shut up in convention. So she's talking, actually her father did not let her read a lot of books as a child. I mean, I guess she had access to his library, but there were certain books that had to be hidden from his eye.
What was this about him buying her books, but he didn't want her, he encouraged her not to read them?
Yeah, there's some story like that.
She says it a couple of times in this, this
Higginson letters.
Maybe that's the way he encouraged her to read them.
I don't think her father was all that weird, really. I mean, he was just kind of, I mean, all that puritanical, or as he's made out to be. He was supposedly a really fine, or a good orator, and in his, the way he would handle his cases was supposed to be impressive. You know, a lot of confidence and ease with speaking publicly.
What about her mother?
Nothing. I don't know anything about her mother.
There's something about her mother.
Oh, her mother got sick.
She was sick.
Okay.
Excuse me. Could you read that quote again?
Which one about? Well, it's not a. It's seen her brain go round. Then it's paraphrased. She would have known that she had the madness of a poet. Would not stay shut up in convention. She uses this, she has this way of using words which is very primitive, or seemingly primitive, but at the same time, what they mean is far from being primitive. There's one verse here. Our share of night to bear, our share of mourning, our blank in bliss to fill, our blank in scorning. Here a star and there a star, some lose their way. Here a mist and there a mist, afterwards day. That day is some reason. Can't hear you. Somebody say something? Is there a dog behind that curtain? Okay. She then, some of her images, she uses images as if they were objects, but these objects turn into these incredible abstractions. I mean, these objects, they're abstractions used as if they were objects. That's what I'm trying to say. There's one poem where she has, at 3:30, a single bird, At 4:30, the bird's full song becomes a silver principle. And at 7:30, the song is over, but both as the element, she uses the word element and implement, while the bird that says, that sings the song, has turned itself into presence beyond circumference. And the bird is gone, and what remains is place. Let me see if I can find this poem. At 3:30, a single bird, page 177, for those of you who have this. At 3:30, a single bird unto a silent sky propounded but a single term of cautious melody. At 4:30, experiment had subjugated test, and lo, her silver principle supplanted all the rest. At 7:30, element nor implement was seen, and place was where the presence was, circumference between. Can you follow that? I mean, it really gets very abstract. The single bird propounds a single term of cautious melody. Experiment subjugates test, and lo, her silver principle, which is the song, supplants all the rest. At 7:30, element nor implement was seen. And place was where the presence was, circumference between. But just these words, like, I mean, they're very abstract words, presence, element, circumference. Buddhist? She's very meditative. I mean, I was telling somebody who was going on retreat, they're allowed to take some one sacred text, and I suggested Emily Dickinson. Okay. Then also, you might think about her. Actually, this list of things I've been going down is just sort of things to think about when you're reading these poems. But she does have this, her own voice. I hate that phrase, actually. They say about poets. Ron Padgett has a funny poem where he says, does that mean the village voice? You know, somebody's talking about the poet's voice. Anyway. This tone, I think, that comes from being so isolated with yourself, in a way, although she was certainly picking up a lot from the outside, but there's a real... particular quality of that, I mean, that has to do with her being this, you know, that isolated, that I think it's her own stance in the poems, and sometimes she's an actor, or much the way she is in her letters, sort of I don't know, some kind of character that's always presence in her poems. And whether it's the, you know, Emily Dickinson personally is one thing, but I think it does come out of, you know, her life situation, her private, you know, like this private space that she was in terms of her writing. Okay. So she uses these very orthodox forms. She wrote in she really needed rhyme and meter. And in fact, in some of her later poems, she tries to get away from that a little and find, you know, isn't as comfortable. But she needed these very orthodox forms. Maybe it's been suggested, you know, to express very unorthodox views or ideas or whatever. All her poems employ meters derived from English hymnology. They're usually iambic. Does everybody know what that means? You should look it up. Well, it's one short foot followed by a long. That's iambic and trochaic and dactylic. A trochaic is the opposite, and then dactylic is one long and two short. Okay, these metric forms were familiar from her childhood as hymn measures, and specifically Watts hymns. He was a hymnist. And a book called, I think it's called either Christian Psalmody or a collection of Watts called the Psalms, Hymns, and Spiritual Songs, were really fixtures in every New England household. So, in fact, both these books were owned by her father, and one of them, I think the latter one, this Psalms, Hymns, and Spiritual Songs, was bound in brown sheepskin and had his name in gold letters. Musical notations accompany each song, and the meter is always named. And also instructions explain which effects may be best achieved by which meters. And they, you know, the book actually discusses the advantage of 1 meter over another for different occasions. So she didn't really have to go very far for this lesson in metrics. I said that before. Okay, the principal iambic meters are these. The common meter, which is 8 and 6 syllables to the line. That's the most frequently used. In fact, Blake uses that as well. So you have 8 syllables, 4 syllables, 8 syllables, 4 syllables. The long meter, which is 8 syllables per line, and which tends to get monotonous. In fact, she avoided doing that over and over again. And then the short meter, which was 2 lines of 6 syllables, followed by 1 of 8, then 1 of 6. And we're talking about quatrains now, okay? Each of these meters has 4 lines to the stanza. So their syllabic scheme goes thus. Common meter, 8, 6, 8, 6. Long meter, 8, 8, 8, 8. Short meter, 6, 6, 8, 6. And each may be doubled in length to make 8-line stanzas or 6-line stanzas. And then there's something called common particular meter, which has the metric beat. This is a 6-line stanza, 8, 8, 6, 8, 8, 6. And short particular meter is 6, 6, 8, 6, 6, 8. And then there are other possible arrangements. One of the more popular ones was 7, 6, 7, 6. And also sixes, just 6 lines. 6 syllables per line. Okay, the principal trochaic meters are sevens, either all sevens, or 8s and 7s, or 8s and 5s, or 7s and 5s. You really go nuts doing this. Anyway, 6s and 5s, and just 6s. And then the dactyls, and she doesn't have too many dactyls, are arranged principally in 11s, 11s and 10s, and 10s and 9s. Okay, it says here now, this is another question, just when, how to date her poems. They're dated in terms of her handwriting, and but it's also possible that she could have copied poems at a later date and destroyed the originals, so one really doesn't know. But it's suggested that all of her poems composed before 61, remember she was born in 1830, it's probably started, was writing poems in her teens, is fashioned in one or another of the hymn meters. Okay, a lot of them are, most of them are in common meter. And she used this, as I said, she used this long meter, which is this sort of monotonous 8 syllables per line, more sparingly. And the trochaics are chiefly 8s and 7s and 8s and 5s. Okay. And then she has these later combinations of things. She really gets sort of carried away. She perceived how to get these new effects by sort of playing with these traditional meters. And in some poems, she starts merging them. The iambs will shift to trochees and the trochees to dactyls. And then sometimes they're all merged. We don't have much time, but let me just, I wanted to also go into rhyme a little. Okay, Okay, look, why don't we turn to 71? Because the first common meter. This is a common meter verse, although then there's something that's called a catalectic, which means the last syllable is dropped. She sometimes does that. I taste a liquor never brewed from tanker scooped in pearl. Not all the vats upon the Rhine yield such an alcohol. I taste a liquor never brewed eight from tanker scooped in pearl, which is from tanker scooped in pearl six. And then the next one is this catalectic. Not all the vats upon the Rhine, not all the vats upon the Rhine yield such an alcohol. Also, she pioneered with rhyme as well, and she extended this range of variation more or less four different kinds of rhymes. Formerly, there had been exact rhymes, which that's obvious, exact rhymes, and I rhymes. I rhymes would be something like come and home, say. Four types. One is identical rhymes, where you just repeat the word, or something like move and remove. Vowel rhymes, imperfect rhymes. An imperfect rhyme is an identical vowel followed by different consonants. That's an imperfect rhyme. A suspended rhyme is the opposite. Different vowels followed by the same consonants. So you have birds, bards would be a suspended rhyme. Meat, fat. Imperfect rhyme would be arose, coast, or time, thine. Okay. So in this poem, you have pearl and alcohol, which is imperfect. Also, there's a variation for this line, not all the vats upon the Rhine. Another version has not all the Frankfurt berries, not all the Frankfurt berries, which would make it eight rather than seven. So it wouldn't be catalectic. I don't know if she was, I'm sure she was aware, you know, aware of how, you know, it was very particular in a way. Okay. This is a great poem. Inebriate of air am I, and debauchee of dew, reeling through endless summer days from inns of molten blue. When landlords turn the drunken bee out of the foxglove's door, when butterflies renounce their drams, I shall but drink the more. Till seraphs swing their snowy hats and saints to windows run to see the little tippler leaning against the sun or from manzanilla come. I think leaning against the sun is probably the preferred. Because so you have another catalectic there to see the little tippler. Okay, there's here's a poem. It's not in here. This is a poem that moves from has three verses or two verses in common meter, then gets into the sixes and sevens, and then trochaic sixes and fives, and then sixes and fives. And I'll just close reading this. And also the first stanza, if you can follow this, has perfect rhyme. Second stanza has perfect rhyme. Third stanza has imperfect rhyme. Fourth has suspended rhyme. And the last has perfect rhyme. Okay. I never told the buried goal upon the hills that lies. I saw the sun, his plunder done, crouch low to guard his prize. He stood as near as stood you here. A pace had been between. Did but a snake dissect the break, my life had forfeit been. That was a wondrous booty, I hoped 'twas honest gained. Those were the fairest ingots that ever kissed the spade. Whether to keep the secret, whether to reveal, whether as I ponder, kid will sudden sail. Kid meaning Captain Kid. Did you get that though in that verse, these trochaic sixes and fives? Whether to keep the secret, whether to reveal, whether as I ponder, kid will sudden sail. Sixes and fives. Could a shrewd advise me, we might e'en divide. Should a shrewd betray me, Atropos decide. Atropos was the senior member of the old Moon Triad, which I read, there was something in this book that I reading earlier, came across the nine moon goddesses, and they're representatives of Hera, and participate in a festival of the wild one. Okay, so we'll get back to a little more Dickinson next time, and start reading read as much as you can of the Jane Austen. How many have started that book, Mansfield Park? It's just going to be dull if you don't start reading it.
Did everybody get a syllabus by now?
Any questions? I'm sorry we haven't had much time for discussion, but I promise next week maybe we can start off the class talking, having you talk more.
There's a poetry journal.